Hi, and welcome this evening to Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. Tonight, I am speaking with Carrie Cannon, who is the author of Uncovering the Divine Within, A Journey of Self-Love. I have to say, this was a pleasure to read, and I really enjoyed it. And we're going to talk about the journey that Carrie has gone through, as well as some very interesting ways that she discovered her own self-love. So welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Lori, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, I look forward to this. So why don't we talk a little bit, I guess, about, you know, what really started you to be on the journey that you're on right now? I know there were some personal things that happened to you at a very young age, but, you know, what was it that really set you on this course?
Around the time that I got married, I was given the wonderful gift of my husband making a lot more money than me. And he said to me, Carrie, why don't you quit your job and do what you really want to do? And I thought to myself, okay, if I can do whatever I want to do, I'm going to figure out my life purpose. So I had always been involved in my own inner seeking and my own spirituality, and I always kind of really rejected the religion that was passed down to me. And at the time, I was studying A Course in Miracles. And I did an internet search, and this is back in 1997, and, you know, the internet was not as big as it is now. And I came across an article titled Your Special Function According to A Course in Miracles. Now, I had read, you know, different books that would tell me what I was good at doing, and you know, they just told me what I was good at doing, but they didn't tell me what would be fulfilling. But within this article written by a man named John Snodgrass, he said, what you perceive to be the reality of your own guilt, sin, or victimization is the exact polar opposite of your special function. The title of the article was Your Special Function According to A Course in Miracles. And he said, what is missing is your gift. Your weakness is your strength. And your special dysfunction is your special function. Now, and I'll go into the backstory about this in a minute, but I had always had self-esteem issues. I always had self-image issues, and I always thought that I was fat. And so I asked myself, okay, well, what's my special dysfunction? I'm fat. And I was like, wrong. No, that's not really it. I don't like myself. And I was like, is that really my special dysfunction? No, that's not it either. I don't love myself. And when I had that thought, I started jumping up and down around the living room, thanking everybody who had ever hurt me. Because in that moment, I so perfectly perceived exactly why everything had happened to me in my childhood and in my life. For example, when I was about 6 years old, I was in a car with my grandmother going on a shopping trip, and she asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I said, I'm going to be a singer. And she said, well, if you're going to be a singer, you better be skinny, because singers are skinny. And I couldn't think of any singers who weren't skinny. So I believe that to be true. But also, Lori, she was reinforcing my feelings that I couldn't be a singer if I was not skinny. And then when I was 8, I was in ballet class, and I had been in ballet since I was 4. And we were doing Russian splits, and those are the side-to-side splits, not the front and back splits. And I could not get all the way down to the ground. Not all the way down to the ground is like 2 inches, okay? And she came over and she called me a fat tub of lard. And yeah, and my mother yanked me out of ballet, but it hurt. You know, it was like I had been revealed. And I carried that with me into adulthood. And then the one that took me a lot longer, the childhood wound that I have recognized that took me really a lot longer to identify was, when I was a little bit older, my parents had gone through a divorce, and we moved out to where my stepmom had been living, and she had a house on a lake. And every day I was now riding the school bus with this boy who came from an extremely affluent family. In fact, they were probably the richest family in the entire county. And every day on the school bus, my morning affirmation from him was fat. He called me fat, screaming at the top of his voice every morning. And I had a crush on this guy. Mm. And it was like, here I was, I have this crush on this guy who's calling, screaming fat at me every day. And at one point, this other boy said to him, hey, why are you calling her fat? You're fat yourself, so why are you doing that to her? And it didn't dawn on me until years later that he had self-image issues. And I realized along the way that all of these people who ever projected anything onto me were trying to point out the thing in me that they perceived was wrong with themselves so that they could make themselves feel better or put the attention on somebody else. But it was really their own stuff that they were seeing in me. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother died of diabetes, or she died with diabetes. Mm-hmm. She was insulin dependent. And my ballet teacher was in the dance industry, and it's notorious for ripping girls and women apart. Mm-hmm. And the boy on the bus obviously had his own issues too. So, once I was able to remove myself from that, I could see that really it had nothing to do with me. None of these experiences had anything to do with me except my perception of myself and those experiences. And they all provided me with the context to understand the content of my thinking.
Yeah. But I mean, you speak even in the book that, you even speak of when you were much younger, when your daddy called you pumpkin, mm-hmm. and you thought he was saying pumpkin. Mm-hmm. So you had this experience of thinking he was telling you you were fat, and that mm-hmm. your mother also played a game called So Big. And you mm-hmm. again. So, I mean, you actually obviously chose to come into this life with this issue wanting to heal so that you could get to the place of self-love. Like, this wasn't yeah. just these experiences with, at 6 and 8. I mean, it had to have come.
Yeah, I came in with this.
Yes.
Because mm-hmm. it was pre-verbal. Those experiences that you just mentioned, my dad would call me pumpkin, and he adored me. Mm-hmm. He called me pumpkin because he just adored me. And when I asked my mom why he called me pumpkin, she said, oh, because he just loves you so much, and he's always wanted a pumpkin of his very own. And I was like, oh, yeah. Well, I thought he called me pumpkin because I was so fat, not because I was so big, Mm-hmm. And same with the So Big game. That's when you're learning how to stand, when you're learning how to walk, to keep your kids' attention away from their feet. Mm-hmm. And, I came in with all of that.
Mm-hmm. Which it's an important thing for us to understand that often our issues, yes, they occur in this life and they're revalidated in this life, but we often come in with predetermined things that we're wanting to work through so that we can get where we're wanting to go. If it's big enough for us, it will push mm-hmm. us towards our own self-realization or our own awakening.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much. And even to this day, it's so funny because, I work with a personal trainer and I go out and I work out at the gym and I go for walks. And still, I'm just like, man, still working on it. And at this point, it's funny because, I still have investment in that thought. Mm. And as aware as I am, it's still sticky, It's like, man. But now I can laugh at it, Now it's
Which
just like, I think it's like this ridiculous thing, but I've still got it, So.
I think women and body image is a huge, and now it's even moving into boys and young mm. teens, with the male teens, which is very interesting because it's never really been there. It's a little bit different, but so it's really becoming a huge issue, and certainly the media and how, it all has to change because it's a big reinforcement of an issue that keeps us stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And fearful, yeah. and a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that it has really shown me is that it really does come down to your thoughts. It really comes down to my thoughts. And I can have days when, actually most days, I'll look in the mirror, and regardless of how soft and curvy I am, I perceive myself as looking beautiful. And there are other days, which are very, very rare now, but, you know, sometimes I have those days. Mm-hmm. And I look in the mirror and I'm just, you know, the fat thought is there. It's like, man. But it is what keeps me going, because it forces me to be introspective about myself. And that is really the thing that has helped me to keep going.
Mm. Right. So a lovely point that you make near the beginning is the love we are seeking is our own self-love. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this journey of your leading you towards your own self-love, there are a lot of people that really, I mean, really all we want is to be loved. Mm-hmm. And we put it outside of ourselves, but mm-hmm. really it is completely within us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's much more than body image. I mean, my body image thing is just, you know, it's just like the surface stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, actually, since I've written the book, and because I started writing this book several years ago, mm-hmm. and then, you know, it takes a long time, mm-hmm. you know, to get them. And since then, I've realized that, you know, everything that is in my life is there for my greater spiritual growth. And if I resist it, I'm resisting myself, regardless of how it shows up, regardless of what it is. Mm-hmm. And like, for example, if I'm feeling agitated or angry and I resist that and I don't acknowledge it and accept that that's the way I'm feeling, it just gets worse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I can acknowledge it and just put it out there, however it comes out, then it doesn't get explosive. You know, it just kind of, you know, if, say, for example, you know, something's happening in my life and, you know, something is irritating me, if I acknowledge the irritation, even if it's coming from somebody else, and say, yo, this is just not really feeling right, then it just flows out of the experience. It seems like the more we resist it, the more it stays in our experience. And the moment we acknowledge it, it is allowed to free itself from us.
Yeah. And then you say, we can't fix something that isn't broken, so we need to experience something that is broken to give us the incentive to work on it.
Just.
And I think, you know, we often want, we don't realize that these are our greatest gifts. These experiences that we have that push us so that we feel that we're broken or something's missing or something's very painful in our lives, and that those are actually the gifts in our life to help us heal.
Yes, yes, very much so. And to the degree that we are allowing to introspect and see what's going on and why we've created these things, that's the degree that we will transcend them.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about our thoughts and how our thoughts, we need to create and reprogram our thoughts, because really our thoughts are what create everything within our lives. And you really have found a way to ground this understanding, because you it feels like you've really experienced it in a very profound way, so that you can understand exactly what's been going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I generally do with my own, with the process that is sort of outlined in the book, is basically starting from things that, from way back, you know, when, like, the thing that happened to you when you were 8 years old and you still are like, man, I can't believe I allowed that teacher to do that or whatever, or that teacher did that to me. Those are the experiences that are the easiest to find, because they're the ones that really we can identify that need healing. And the process that I outline in the book is pretty much to write down all of those experiences that have really had an adverse effect on your peace of mind. And once you write them all down, see if you can find that common thread. You know, is there a common thread in all of those things? Is it a worth thing. Maybe it's many things. You know, maybe it's several different things. Like for me, you know, it was my body image. Later on, it was self-worth showed up in all of that. And the thread that tied all of those things together was my ability or lack of ability to love myself. And, you know, Lori, with the self-love comes self-trust, self-compassion, everything. And allowing yourself to just be peaceful and allow yourself to flow and know that life will lead you where you need to be. But the process that I use is to just name it. Because if you look at each trait, there's a couple different processes I use. One is to list your traits, you know, what you perceive as good and what you perceive as bad. Throw out the good, okay? Okay, we think you're great. We know you're great. So that's not something you need to work on. But look at the traits you perceive as bad. And, for example, for me, again, going back to the body image issue, looking at, all right, fat. In and of itself, is it a bad thing? I have fat cats that I love. Does that make them unlovable? No, of course not. You know, in some cultures, women who are more robust are considered beautiful. You know, back in a couple hundred years ago, it was considered beautiful to be a little bit softer and a little more rounded. Mm-hmm. And so in and of itself, is it a bad thing? No. We can certainly say, oh, there are health issues and this and that, but that's not the issue. It's the trait itself. And we tend to pick ourselves apart. But when we look closer at each trait that we perceive that we are or we have, then we can see that that trait in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with it. It's benign. It's not good or bad. It just is what it is.
Mm-hmm. And also you said that you used to believe that you are the person you are because of the experiences you had.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're aware that the thoughts of who you are, you then experience them. So it's through the thoughts of who you are that you experience those thoughts.
Yes. The thought comes first. Then you have your experience. And then you can see the context of, you know, that experience provides you the context to understand what your thoughts are. And then if you don't like the context or the experience that you're having through that context, then you can, that's your gift to change your thought. Because if you don't like that experience, like, oh, okay, what don't I like about this experience? Oh, I don't like that I'm not making enough money. Okay, well, then I need to shift my thoughts about money and my own worth, my own value. So it's a constant thing. And as we look at our experiences, if we can look at our experiences and say, huh, why did I create that? Then we can see, oh, this is the thought that I was having that created that. All right, I need to work on that one. But it requires one to be extremely mindful of what is going on in each moment, in each experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not mindful, then we'll keep experiencing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Because the universe is unbiased and non-judgmental. So when we have these thoughts, and I think this is the biggest thing that people, it's really difficult when you're caught up in the painful process of not really being aware of our responsibility with our own thoughts. And when we say responsibility, a lot of people get even uptight about that because then they think, well, now you're telling me that it's my fault.
Right.
So it really is an interesting process that people have to understand that responsibility is all about freedom because, again, it shows us, and I like how you put it, the gift.
Because
it's all about really seeing these as gifts and opportunities to allow us to change what we're perceiving, what we perceive as our experience.
Right. Exactly. And when we take, you're exactly right. When we do take responsibility, that is like complete freedom. Oh, I am the creator of my life, the way I experience it. I have freedom to do what I want because I am completely responsible for everything in my life. Wow. You know, that is free will.
Mm-hmm.
It's the freedom to will what you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, also, you know, because we do create our universe, and what we perceived as flawed and limited and lacking in our life, it's we've actually drawn these experiences. So really, you know, understand that our experiences gives us validation and understanding of what we think. So it's mm-hmm. really, you know, we really get to change this by mm-hmm. understanding and being aware. And right. it was very clear how you wrote that. And I think, you know, the book, if people get this book, I mean, they really can get a clearer understanding of this process, because I think it's very powerful to understand our responsibility and how our thoughts impact our lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I appreciate your response to the book.
Yeah. So let's talk about forgiveness, because that's the other big area that it almost was like once you realized your gift, once you realized the gift that others gave you, you were able to completely forgive them.
Yeah. I had the most profound experience I had. I mean, after jumping around the living room and thanking my grandmother and my ballet teacher, I had given a speech at a club, and the title of the speech was, "Whatever Doesn't Kill You Only Makes You Stronger." Mm. And in that speech, I talked about the kid on the bus who, you know, called me fat every day. And then I talked about how he was seeing in me the thing that, you know, he perceived was flawed in himself. And when I gave that speech, I felt a relief. Mm. And that the next night, or I don't know if it was that night or the following night, it doesn't really matter, I had a dream where I was at this huge round table. And to me, the table represented the earth after mm. I, you know, the world. Mm-hmm. And he was to my right. He was directly to my right. And as I started talking about how he, because I was re-delivering the speech at like this table, which actually I'm having an experience right now mm-hmm. that is very much in correlation with this story that I'm telling. So it's kind of interesting and weird. Mm-hmm. But as I'm telling all these people around this huge round table my story about him and me on the school bus, he started becoming visibly nervous, and I rubbed his back, and I kind of put my hand on his thigh to be like, it's okay, and I, you know, rubbed his shoulder, and I said to him, I was like, no, you don't understand. I was like, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't be where I am now. You helped me heal. And then afterwards, I gave him the most healing hug, and it was just so filled with love. It was so loving, and it was like this flood of love came over me for this guy, and I had never experienced it before. And then I woke up, and oh, I just felt so much love for this person for delivering me that experience. Because had he not been so good at what he did, I would not have so profoundly been able to heal that. Mm-hmm. You know, had the mark not been so hard to handle, then I might still be lost. Mm-hmm. So in that experience that he gave me of being so mean, he, deep down underneath, I recognized that he loved me, that he loves me, because you cannot deliver something so profound to somebody unless deep down underneath you truly love that person. Now, he may not be aware. I'm sure he's not aware that he loves me. You know, on a different level than, you know, the, oh, I love you, you love me level. This is on the pure essence level of who he really is. He loves me. Mm-hmm. And so does everybody who delivers those experiences to us, because they are there to show us what we are thinking about ourselves. And it takes a pure love deep down underneath to deliver one an experience so profound that you are willing to allow that person to hate you for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Even though they're not aware.
Yep.
Yeah. So let's go, because I liked how you wrote about what forgiveness is not and what forgiveness is, because, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about forgiveness and you hear them say, oh, I've forgiven that person, but yet you know or you feel that they just haven't been able to do it. And, you know, it's when these people, you know, still feel or that they're forgiving when they feel they're superior or self-righteous to somebody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or they're still feeling betrayal and pain.
Right.
Or that they belittle the person to others.
Yeah.
Or that they revisit the past as a reminder of the pain that was caused. So, I mean, it's really important to understand, talk about what your experience of forgiveness is.
Well, I wrote in the book, and I had heard somebody on the radio at one point talking about forgiveness. And, Lori, do I keep fading in and out? Cause my
No, it's very clear.
Great,
it's beautiful.
Great, okay. Some examples of what forgiveness is not is exactly what you said, claiming to forgive another and feeling superiority or self-righteousness, holding lingering pain or feelings of betrayal, belittling that person to other people, you know, saying, oh, I forgive them, but yeah, he's a jerk. claiming to forgive, yet revisiting the incident over and over and over again. These are all what forgiveness is not.
And that doctor, though, in the example that you gave, I mean, without, you know, naming who it was or anything, but I mean, it was very clear that this person had didn't know anything about forgiveness.
Well, I believe this person during that time was going through a lot of public stuff, and she had not experienced forgiveness. And she needed to forgive herself for some things that had been going on. So I feel like that was her own walls. You know, that was her inability to forgive herself for what was going on. But some examples of what forgiveness is are absolving the perpetrator of all responsibility for making you feel badly. Understanding that people act from their own experience and you are reflecting back to them something they want to dissociate from themselves, which is something I talked about earlier. Understanding that no one ever could hurt you because you are incapable of actually being harmed at the core of who you are. It's just our perceptions of that we're hurt. And understanding that anyone who delivers a painful experience to you is only showing you a portion of your thinking that needs to be corrected and healed. And in those last two, in not being the not actually being capable of being harmed, and the healing you're thinking, to me, that's the key. To look at it as, okay, you know, I've created this for myself, for my betterment, for my good. What do I need? What does Carrie need to address, or what does, you know, the listener need to address within themselves to heal this limiting perception of the self.
Yeah, because we, you know, it is all illusion, and we really, you know, if they never really hurt us, and I think that's the one thing that, you know, maybe people don't get, but if we are eternal beings and we can't actually be hurt, and it's just our perception of what happened, what is it, you know, what is it then that they've allowed us to understand about ourselves? What gift is it that they've given us?
Right. And, you know, it's another easy thing to do is just to look at our projections. You know, it's said that, you know, when you point a finger at somebody, you're pointing a tree back at yourself. And that is so true. I mean, you know, telling somebody that they've betrayed you or whatever. Oh, you've betrayed me. Oh, okay. How have I betrayed myself in this situation? You know, am I not being true to myself? Am I not stating my truth? Am I not honoring my own integrity? You know, those are all things to look at. And sometimes, and I just learned this week, and not that I just learned it, but it's something that I've known for a long time, but I've never really known the concept of the shadow self, which is when you have sort of claimed yourself and claimed your integrity, you'll still see the shadow self. And I have this quality about me that is, like, I'm extremely passionate about my work. In fact, that's the one thing in my life that I'm most passionate about my work. And I do it with full integrity. I very much walk my talk. And of course, you know, sometimes I'll, like everybody, I mean, I'm not cooked yet. Nobody's cooked. I will still find things that it's like, man, that's irritating to me. And I'll look at it and I'll see it. And one of the things that I find, and when my integrity police comes out the most, is when people place themselves on pedestals of authority, because I have investment in that thought. And I realize that my job is not to tell other people how it is. My job is to help people see how they've created it for themselves. And oftentimes I will find people who profess to be teachers or healers or whatever, and are asking people to defer to them for their wisdom, insight, and knowledge. And it's like, no. Mm-hmm. You know, a real teacher will always have you look within. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be my button, which I just found out this week that the reason I identify with that is because that's my shadow self. Because mm-hmm. I know that I could potentially fall into that category of people who say, this is the way it is, you must follow the way that I do it, like a dogma. Mm. And that is harmful to everyone, because we're all equal. There's no superiority. And really, we are one mind. And it's just reflecting off of each other to see how the self shows up from each different perspective. But I've just sort of been introduced to that concept. So I guess what I'm getting at is yes, sometimes we will see things and we'll be able to look at something and say, hey, this is out of alignment. But it's not necessarily that you're out of alignment. You might very well be in alignment, but it's an aspect of yourself that you fear that you could, you know, because it is something within all, you know, the infinite realm of possibilities, since I am in a position that I'm in, that I could abuse it. Sure. And become, you know, that it could be, quote, harmful. Not that anybody can actually be harmed, but it would harm my integrity to do that. And it would be harmful to me. So when it shows up, I kind of I kind of point at it and scream at it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that's the beauty of people that live in their integrity, because I think, you know, there are a lot of people that get caught up in their spiritual ego and don't realize that that's what they're doing. And yes, I guess that's when we get into judgments and we're starting to judge and we're starting to see that. But, you know, it's a fine line, because the ego is strong in both areas. And, you know, it's something to be ever always aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. And you talk about defining ourselves and how we limit ourselves. And really, you know, it's all about how we are in this tiny little planet with over 6 billion people on it, and yet we still somehow manage to feel separate and different. And it's that aspect of ourselves, though, that you say is what makes us so unique.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, because it's kind of like, the things that we use to define ourselves separates us. You know, that's our perception of separation. Whatever you perceive it is that makes you different from everybody else, that is the thing that you need to heal. Mm-hmm. And often, like, for example, I have friends that are very, very aware from childhood, you know, had, you know, like cosmic experiences and everything. However, that's the thing that they perceive separates them from everybody else. So they can't embrace that awareness and that total gift, because they perceive it as something that makes them different. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, we can judge something as good, you know, from, you know, not being in a certain perceptual point of view, but everybody has something that at one point or another, we perceive separates us from everybody else. And it's embracing that, embracing the thing that makes us unique. Because, and like the example that I used in the book was, you know, an alcoholic, once you are a recovered alcoholic, you use that to look at yourself, to heal yourself, and then that's your gift to other people, to help them heal what's going on inside of them, because it's kind of like a been there, done that kind of thing. And then you can help people to see more clearly, say, okay, I've been here, so let me show you what I've seen in myself, and perhaps that will help you see the same thing in yourself. And then together, you know, we can heal, because as you're helping somebody else, you're also helping yourself. Really, there is nobody else. You're helping yourself all the way. And in that way, to give of yourself completely, once you've identified and sort of reframed your experience, then if you can just give it away and allow other people to see it and share all of yourself with people, then that becomes your special function or your life purpose or whatever you want to call it, the thing that brings you the most bliss.
And you talk about, you know, judgments and how, you know, you couldn't really handle your own judgments, so you projected those thoughts and interpreted others as judging you. And then you talk about how, you know, when you would see slender women and when you would see heavier women, talk about what that was like, because I think, you know, people need to see and understand examples so that they also get that part as clearly as you've been able to express it and experience it.
Well, at the time when I had the first revelation experience, like I said, I was a student of A Course in Miracles. And in A Course in Miracles, it states that there are no positive judgments. You know, every judgment is a judgment. You know, you can't differentiate between what's a positive judgment and a negative judgment. And people are like, oh, no. You know, I was saying that she looked pretty or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, if we're judging anything, it's always a judgment on ourselves. And the examples that I used in a book was, since I had body image issues, I would look at women and I would size them up and I would base my judgment. So if a woman was heavier than I was, I would think thoughts like, she shouldn't be eating that ice cream cone, she should be out walking, she's pouring out of her jeans, just anything that I could think of to belittle somebody else in comparison to myself. You know, like, yeah, she might look, have a nice suit on, but she still looks fat, or whatever it is. The opposite of the negative judgment is the perceived positive judgment, which would sound something like, oh, she looks really great. She doesn't look like she's had three kids. Or, you know, she looks great in her jeans. Look at her hair. Wow, she looks beautiful. Yeah, she probably can eat that ice cream cone. She probably has a really fast metabolism. And all of these things, now depending upon how one perceives the self, you know, those types of thoughts coming out of a mouth might not, or a mind, might not always be a judgment. It might just be an observation. However, when it comes from a place of feeling like one is superior to another, you place that other person, in the example of the thin woman compared to the fat woman thinking the thoughts, you place that woman on a pedestal of, you know, superiority, and it's someplace that you perceive you can never reach. So in that quote positive judgment of that other person, what you're really doing is it's a negative judgment on you, because you're saying, I've had three kids and I look like I look so fat I have to wear sweatsuits all the time. Or, you know, I can't eat that ice cream cone and enjoy it because, look, I've got 60 pounds to lose. Or, you know, she looks really good in those jeans, but I could never wear a pair of jeans like that because I, you know, I would be rolling out of them. So we really have to monitor all of our thoughts, because we will either use thoughts to belittle someone else to try and make us feel better about ourselves, or we will use thoughts to try and elevate someone else to belittle ourselves. And either way you mix it, you're belittling yourself, because you're either trying to throw away, to disown that aspect of yourself, or you're placing somebody else up on a pedestal so that, you know, to reinforce your own feelings of inadequacy. And it doesn't, since my experience is body image, that's my easiest example to use. But it can be, you know, it can be anything. It can be money. It can be whatever. It can be anything.
All right. And I guess, you know, that's, again, it kind of flows in with giving our power away, because we're so focused on, you know, either someone being superior or somebody being inferior, that we're actually giving that power away to different people, whether we see, regardless of which way it is, whether it's the positive or the negative, it's still giving our power away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every time that we see something outside of ourselves and we sort of name it as this or that, and we don't look within and find out what that trigger is, or claim ourselves and say, oh, okay, why am I thinking this thought? You know, because the more we look within and the more mindful we are about, okay, why is this thought coming in? Why am I thinking this thought? Why is this showing up for me? Why three times in a day has this type of experience happened to me? You know, it's always an opportunity to look at ourselves and say, okay, you know, stop. Why am I creating this experience for myself where I'm perceiving that somebody is better than I am? And then giving my power away to it, because we create, and this is the thing going back to the teacher thing too, where to me that's sort of a conscious, here you give your power away to me. What we do is we're so quick to sort of be nice and try and placate other people, because we perceive that everybody else is outside of us and all of these experiences are outside of us. And instead of looking at ourselves and seeing why we created anything, we give it away all the time, and then we disempower ourselves with every thought of another that they have some quality that we don't, or that's not part of us, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting how we create our experiences to help us understand this. I mean, it's really important about awareness and being, you know, so observant all the time of what we're thinking, feeling, and being.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes the closer we are to the situation, the harder it is to see. For example, I have a friend who I've been very close to for the last 7 years, and we haven't talked for a while, because we've had some stuff that we have needed to sort out. And the further away I get from that, the more acutely I can see the relationship dynamic that was going on. So sometimes we do kind of need to, it's not always easy to see, because if you're right on top of it, you know, if there's something on your nose, you can't see it, you know. Show me a mirror, you know. Tell me that there's something on my nose. But then if we step back from it, you know, if we step away from what it is, it's easier to see sometimes. So sometimes removing ourselves from a situation will help us to see things better. And not even needing to remove ourselves, because the greater part of us, the universe, whatever you want to call it, will remove us from a situation, either willingly, you know, either we'll go willingly or we'll go kicking and screaming, but, you know, either way, we'll be removed from a situation. And in that removal, that's also a gift, because oftentimes we have these great attachments to how things should show up in our lives, and we can't see the whole scope. And the universe will pull us away from a situation, and we'll be able to see it more clearly. And it's like, oh, that's what I was doing to myself. This is what was going on in this dynamic. And if we can release that attachment to how we show up, then we can be more mindful and observe that from sort of a greater distance. And, you know, and we take care of that for ourselves. Like, not meaning that, you know, we physically will remove ourselves from a situation to be able to see it more clearly, but the greater aspect of ourselves, the cosmic aspect of ourselves, will pull the perceptual point of view away from something so that it can be seen more clearly. And it's nice when we can allow that to happen without kicking and screaming.
Yes, definitely nice. When it comes to our special gift and what makes us very unique, I'm sure you must get this a lot, but, you know, you've talked about your own experience, but give people some examples of how they can uncover this so that they really understand it and really get it.
Well, again, I would say, you know, write down the things that you see that are like your experiences. And these experiences go into adulthood. You know, we keep repeating experiences over and over and over again. So, for example, love. Take love. If you are a woman and you've had guys who have been your, you know, best friends as guys, you know, your whole life, but, you know, never get to the marriage part, you know, what part of you is saying, you know, that you're perhaps not good enough to get married, that you're, you know, a tomboy still, or, you know, whatever. What part of you doesn't feel that you're worthy of being loved, you know, that you're lovable in that respect? You know, with money, you know, a lot of times people create this financial lack. And what aspect of you, it's kind of like, you know, we have these self-worth issues, and then we look around ourselves and we see that we're not treating what we do have with respect. So if we're not treating what we have, the possessions that we have, with care and respect, and like keeping our house clean and, you know, all of that, then it's kind of like we don't value our possessions and money, and we do not value it, so therefore money will not value us. So, you know, that's another way of being able to see, you know, a different slant on things. And you know, we might have, you know, there's all sorts of, like, you know, special dysfunction. I mean, we can all name our own, you know, say we were abused as a kid, or you know, we might have had some traumatic experiences, and being able to look at those, see what might have been going on inside at the time, and then being able to see what are the thoughts that perhaps those were showing us about ourselves. And then, Lori, and as you sort of expressed to me in an email, then once you see what it is, you're like, wow, this is the thing that I live for. I live for healing this, you know, if you're suicidal as a teenager or whatever, because you felt depressed and you felt unappreciated and all of that, you can then take that experience and see what you were thinking about yourself. And then as an adult, you can be, you know, you can help people get out of that the way that you did. There's a woman that I talk about in the book who was, I think she was dyslexic or something, and she tried really hard, and she wanted to be a teacher. And she was told, first of all, she came from a family that where she had to take care of everything. Like, her mother was diabetic, and she was in the bed, and she couldn't really move, and then she had to take care of her little brother. And so this woman, from an early age, was just running around doing everything for everybody else. And she wanted to, I don't know if she wanted, I think she wanted to be a teacher, yeah. And then her counselor told her that she couldn't do that. She couldn't handle that. And here's this woman who, like, was taking care of everything her whole life. And then when she came back to the counselor after she had gone away, and she had gone back to school, and she was in NYU, she went to NYU for her degree. Then she came back and she had to do her student teaching in the same school where she had gone to school before. And, you know, she went back to the counselor and she was like, you know, you told me I couldn't do it. And then here now, the last I knew, and this is a couple of years ago, when I was living in D.C., she was running a couple of the very high-end apartment buildings in D.C. And, you know, she thrives on being able to put out fires, you know, on taking care of, like, multiple tasks at a time. And in the book, I talk about her friend, too, who also, they were best friends, who also wanted to be a teacher, but she was in special, like, she got kicked out of 6 different schools, and she wasn't allowed to go to school. She could only go to private school, and she saw that there was a real lack in the special education departments, and she went back, and she became a teacher, and now she really, since she was there, and she knew what was lacking in her education, she came back, and now she's an amazing teacher in the special ed department in some school, and she's, you know, highly regarded because she used her special dysfunction, as we would call it, as we're calling it in this conversation, and she turned it around, she transformed it, and that became her gift.
Right.
And that's what we can all do. We just need to name it, to claim it, and then we can turn it around.
And when you talk about polar opposite, and I know you explained it earlier, but just to have a really clear understanding, explain that.
Okay. So in the two examples that I just used, in the one situation, let's use the more dramatic one that I perceive as more dramatic, where the girl was literally, she was kicked out of 6 different schools because they just couldn't handle her. I don't know if, you know, she was, you know, hyperactive. I don't know what her deal was, really. I just know that she was not being educated the way that she needed to be educated. And her, what she would perceive was wrong with her would be the thing, can you hear me still?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
What she would perceive was wrong with her is an inability to learn and perhaps feeling like she was stupid. So, the flip side of that is to know what it's like to feel stupid and to know what it's like to get kicked out of school and to know what it's like for the school to not be serving you and to flip that around and say, I am the change I wish to see. I am the solution. I am my purpose. I am the person who is going to help these kids gain self-confidence, be able to learn, and she turned that on a dime, and that is the polar opposite of her situation, going from feeling like she was stupid and unable to learn to knowing what it's like and showing other people, hey, I've been there, I've done that, this is now my gift. Mm-hmm. So can you see how those are polar opposites of the same dynamic?
Yeah, and I know you were sort of mentioning what I had emailed you, and so my issue has always been around abandonment. And it wasn't until I was able to, you know, really understand it wasn't just being abandoned. It was actually not being acknowledged. And so in your book, you also talk about how, you know, you have to really give it to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way to I have discovered, which was very exciting this past week, was that, you know, really what I give is acknowledgement to others through my show.
Mm-hmm.
And what I receive is acknowledgement through publishing houses and through the people that I interview. And so it's a very interesting way that I've now realized that this is, you know, definitely part of my purpose.
Yeah. I was very excited when I read that.
Yeah.
I was like, yay, somebody else.
But it's interesting because, you know, we choose different things. And, you know, my schooling, I'd done social work. And being a counselor and being an intuitive counselor, like moving it into my intuition, but still doing the counseling aspect. It was very much who I am. It's very much a part of just generally who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so knowing also, though, that, you know, we take all of our experiences and we kind of bring them all together was one thing, but really understanding that the passion that I now have is really around, you know, the giving and receiving of acknowledgement, like really feeling that, because you don't always feel that with counseling. You don't always get that sort of acknowledgement. It's a listening. It's a, you know, being a compassionate and very much who I am as a person. But it was very interesting when I got that, you know, aspect. So I was very excited too.
I love that one. That's what I live for, Lori. I live, you know, every single time somebody tells me, oh my God, my life was transformed by your book. I'm like, yes, because that's my passion, mm-hmm. you know, helping people to recognize that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I live for, you know. But I just love that. Thank you. That's my gift too. You know, you gave me a gift in letting me know that you, you know, the light went off
mm-hmm.
in that.
Definitely.
So I appreciate that.
So let's end this with, you know, the inner voice. It's an aspect that is incredibly important in understanding everything about who we are. And it's also, you know, the way for us to get some of the answers and understanding our gift.
Well, my perception of the inner voice is when, sometimes you'll feel like a tap. You know, you'll have a thought and it'll kind of tap. And we ignore it. And then, like, say we're living in a big glass house, okay? And then the rock will get a little bigger. And it'll be a tap that might turn into a little, you know, broken piece of glass. And if we still ignore it, then the rocks will get bigger and bigger and bigger until there's a wrecking ball coming to tear down our house. And then we end up in crisis. So, those little taps, when we hear the taps, it's kind of like in you know, it's been said what you resist persists.
Mm.
And those little taps are our higher self. And we can write too. You know, I've done a lot of journaling, asking myself, or, you know, dowsing, using the pendulum, asking myself, to just get in tune with that inner voice. To find out what exactly it is that I am thinking, you know. But I find that if you can listen to the taps, and if it seems like a persistent thing, that's your inner voice. And the inner voice will always, always be positive. It will always be a voice of encouragement, and it will always seem like a loving thought. The ego, or the aspect of us that is self-doubt, will be like, no, you can't do that. Or, nobody will ever believe you, or whatever. It's always, you know, doubtful. Mm-hmm. It's our fear.
Mm-hmm.
And the inner voice will ask us, well, at least in my life, I can't say this is the same for everybody, but it generally will ask me to step outside of my box
mm-hmm.
and take that step that I don't know where my foot is going to land. And I seem to find that regardless of how fearful I am, I step on the other side and I'm still alive. You know, I'm still here. And I'm even in a better situation than I was before. And that's always a really, really great thing. I have a friend who, his name is, he's an author. His name is Robert Bruce. And I was going to send some things out to try and get more. I feel like I need better channels to share my work. Mm-hmm. So I was going to be sending them out, and I had kind of been afraid for years to do this. And he's like, Carrie, it's either you're either afraid of success, you're afraid of failure, you're afraid of rejection, you know, whatever. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's rejection. And he's like, well, basically, you know, cut it out, you know. And it was great because then the next week or within 2 weeks, I did what I needed to do for many years. And mm-hmm. now I feel really good about it. Then after I did it, it was kind of like, it's funny because after I dropped my thing in the mail, I could hear very audibly my inner voice saying, well, it's about time, you know. Like, oh, okay, cool, thank you. You know, so that was really neat.
Yeah. Well, I've really enjoyed this. I would like to have you come back because I think the other parts of your book is kind of like the, you know, the laws of being a spiritual person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to have you come back and talk again about, this lovely little book that you've written. And instead of focusing more on the self-love, focusing on all of the different laws that you've kind of come up with that you mention and talk about in your book.
Oh, I would love to come back. Great. I would love to. Thank you.
This is your opportunity now to shamelessly promote yourself. So, yes, let people know how they can get a hold of you.
Okay. Well, you can get to my website by going to divinewithin.com. And actually, right now I'm offering a special. I hadn't been doing personal consultations too much, and I'm doing them, and I'm offering an hour for the price of a half an hour now. So now through Christmas, and then at Christmas I'm going overseas. So and the initial consultation is actually free, and it's 45 minutes, and then after that, people can book up to 10 hours. Reserve up to 10 hours for the price of, 5 hours or 10 half hours.
Nice.
And my book is on there, and I have all sorts of stuff. And again, that's divinewithin.com.
Nice. Well, again, it's been quite lovely, and I look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it so much, Lori.
All right. Take care.
Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.